You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Alyssa Mastromonaco worked as a top aide for President Barack Obama for over 10 years, serving as assistant to the president and deputy chief of staff for operations at the White House from 2011 to 2014. She was one of the youngest women to ever serve in that position and the first woman to occupy an office whose previous inhabitants included the likes of George Stephanopoulos, Rahm Emanuel, Karl Rove, and David Plouffe. In her new book, Who Thought This Was a Good Idea? And Other Questions You Should Have Answers To When You Work in the White House, Ms. Mastromonaco gives a behind-the-scenes account of her time working for President Obama and offers insights into how politics and government work. She's currently the chief operating officer at Vice Media. Her book is published by 12 Books, and I'm very pleased it has brought her to our show today. Hello.
Leonard, thank you.
Weren't you once included in a list of Washington's most powerful, least famous people?
I was.
What exactly does the president's deputy chief of staff operations do?
I oversaw everything on what we called the 18 acres, which was the campus of the White House. And then, so that included everything from the White House military office that ran Camp David, that maintained Air Force One and Marine One, to overseeing presidential personnel. So I was the person, I was one of the people who would interview Jim Comey to be head of the FBI or Jack Lew to be Treasury Secretary. What else? Oversaw scheduling and advance, which was my previous post, which manages all of the logistics and strategy around the president's travel, how he uses his time here and abroad. So that was sort of the scope of my remit.
You write that a lot of people often ask you how a public school kid from upstate New York with no connections and no Ivy League acceptance letters ended up working for the President of the United States just a few feet from the Oval Office. And what do you tell them?
I tell them that, you know, I didn't grow up saying I want to work in the White House. I got into politics when I was in college. I was always interested, you know, like I grew up, I watched the Iran-Contra hearings on TV. I saw Bernie Sanders when I was in Vermont, and Burlington is really political, and I decided to intern, and it ended up being this sort of, you know, transformative experience. And it wasn't because I saw power brokers. It was because I saw that if people are really committed to public service, that someone who calls up with a problem can get it solved.
At that time, did you ever think that he might run for president?
Oh, no, never. I mean, he always seemed someone who was just super contented serving the people of Vermont. And I always sort of followed my gut and my heart and worked for people that I deeply believed in.
Wasn't he also limiting his opportunities by not being a member of the Democratic Party or the Republican Party?
You know, I think that maybe he was, but at the same time, the authenticity that had him just sort of a tried and true independent is ultimately, I think, what brought people to, you know, embrace him in 2015.
What did you do after you graduated from college?
After I graduated from college and I spent the entire summer mailing my resumes around Capitol Hill, not getting a response to any one of them, my very best friend from Rhinebeck, New York, and I decided to move to the city together. She was going to the new school. And I actually took a job as a paralegal in the World Trade Center.
And you say forward motion is always better than no motion, even if you don't think it's taking you in the direction you wanted to go.
Yes. For me, wallowing was never a good look. I would sort of get quite depressed. And so for me, doing something is better than doing nothing. And so even though I had a collection of sort of very strange jobs for part of my life, it was always better and I always learned something.
How did you get involved with John Kerry's 2004 presidential campaign?
I got involved with John Kerry because when my one of my roommates, who was my colleague at the as a paralegal, she ended up going to law school. I went to visit her in Boston, and John Kerry was giving a speech, and I saw it, and I said, "What am I doing? You know, I got to get back in it. I can't give up."
What were you working at the time?
At the time, I was a client services manager at Sotheby's International.
So that's a good preparation for what
you've
done.
I have to tell you, it was a lovely job. I mean, it was kind of hard to leave. But I actually wrote a letter just asking to be an intern and figured I would figure out how to make my money somehow. And they hired me as a staff assistant.
And what was memorable about working on the Kerry campaign, other than the fact that they had 13 different slogans?
13 different slogans. There was an actual poem written about the 13 different slogans, which we still all have. But it was the first time I felt in my professional life that I was really the tip of the spear, where I had real decision-making responsibility, where I oversaw, you know, probably a couple hundred people, part-time and full-time. So that was really memorable. And also the heartbreak of losing is very memorable.
You write about how stressful campaigns are and mm-hmm. how the physical – and about the physical toll that they take on you. How do they take a physical toll on you?
Well, most people either get really skinny or really fat. I unfortunately got quite chubby because you were working all the time. You were on all the time. And there were times when we would eat quite unhealthily, where bagels with extra cheese and meat became the rule, not the exception.
What did you learn from his loss on election night in 2004?
Well, I learned that life goes on. I learned that just because things aren't fair, that, you know, doesn't matter. That's how it is.
Were you surprised? Because a lot of the country was upset that we had gone into a couple of unpopular wars.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think that sometimes the interesting thing is, I think we spent a lot of time trying to, because there were several wars going on and we were running against a sitting president, I think that we focused too much on still trying to make America think he was smart, when maybe he just needed to seem more relatable and like he was on their side.
Did you expect to work for another campaign after that one?
No, I never wanted to work on one again. I didn't.
You write that when you first met Barack Obama in 2004, you weren't sure that he liked you very much.
Yeah, he's a tough customer.
Why did you think that?
He's pretty, you know, laid back, and some people have said aloof, but he's actually not aloof at all. He's just not very emotive sometimes. And I met with him, and he was really concerned with the fact that I wasn't from Illinois.
And why that?
Because he was the junior senator from Illinois. Senator Durbin had been there for a long time, and he had a real connection also to downstate, and didn't want people thinking that after that speech he gave at the convention that he had gone Hollywood. So a connection to Illinois was very important to him.
So were you surprised when he offered you the job?
Yes, I was, because normally I think that I have a real sense when I walk out of something whether I was a hit or a miss, and I thought I was probably a miss after I met with him.
When he was on the show to talk about his memoir,
yep.
I asked him whether he had any plans to run for president, because there were rumors. He said, no. He said, I'm, 48th in line.
Yes.
I'll be sharpening pencils for a long time before
yes.
I ever think of the White House. And, of course, months later, he announced.
He did. And I have to tell you that when he talked to you about that, he was telling you the God's honest truth. It was really after the book came out and he was in Africa. I actually managed his book tour, which gave me good insights for mine. And the enthusiasm, the outpouring of what he meant to people really became apparent as something he should probably think about doing. It was a if not now, then when sort of thought.
I'm speaking with Alyssa Mestromonaco, who, with the help of Lauren Euler, has written Who Thought That Was a Good Idea? And Other Questions You Should Have Answers To When You Work in the White House. Doesn't the title of your book come from a 2008 campaign event for Obama?
It comes from many years of Obama, punctuated by an event in 2008, which was if then-Senator Obama and ultimately President Obama did not like what you had decided he was going to be doing, you would get an email either from him or one of the folks who traveled with him that would say something like, Philly event, who thought this was a good idea, when they knew all well that I was the one who thought it was a good idea. And so in 2008, it was about 2 weeks before the election, President Obama, it's no secret, does not like the cold. He's from Hawaii. And it was quite cold in Pennsylvania, and it was going to snow. And we didn't have an indoor location. We had an outdoor location with no, you know, rain site or bad weather site. And we said, look, you know, McCain's canceling all of his events. His events were outdoors. We are going to crush this. You are going to dominate Philly, you know, Pennsylvania television. And talked to David Plouffe, who's campaign manager. We said, yeah, we're going to keep it. And then we emailed the road and we said, you know, guys, you're going to keep that event in Chester. And they said, you know, who thought this was a good idea? And worst case scenario was that it wasn't snow, it was sleet, pelted him in the face. And the reason that we love the story so much is because the photos taken by the Washington Post won the Pulitzer that year. And so we, when it won, we were like, this was Chester. Look at the picture. That was Chester. And so...
So did he come to think it might have been a good idea?
Yeah, he did. We all got a good giggle for years to come off of that one.
Was he different as president?
No.
The office doesn't change people?
I think it changes people. I think that between the president and the first lady and having the girls there, having Sasha and Malia, I think that he, the person I saw, remained quite constant.
But you say he never yelled or demeaned people, but his most common way of expressing displeasure with a staffer was a raised eyebrow.
Raised eyebrow.
How was election night 2008 different from your election night experience 4 years earlier?
So 4 years earlier in 2004, we thought we were going to win. We were believing exit polls. We all went out. We started celebrating quite early and we were just drunk enough by the time we found out that we were losing and that instead of a celebratory event, we had to plan a concession event. That was so traumatic that in 2008, I was, hyper superstitious. So I went out. It was supposed to be beautiful weather in Chicago. I went to North Face and bought a raincoat just because I thought it would ward away the rain. It did. I'll take credit for that. But I stayed in the office as late as I possibly could and I wouldn't go out. And when they called Ohio, we went and we had our on the campaign, we like to go to Houlihan's for chicken tenders and Pinot Grigio. And so we started doing that. And then they called New Mexico and I think maybe Pennsylvania. And we had these trolleys to take us down to Grant Park. And as we were pulling up, Wolf Blitzer called it and we couldn't believe it. We started to cry and Brad Pitt was in our way. We had to like elbow him. We're like, get away. We did this.
So it's kind of a roller coaster ride on most election nights. You think you're going to lose and you think you're going to win. Then maybe, oh, this state might change things again. What was your first day working at the White House like?
It was really overwhelming. You can't even imagine all of the things you don't know when you walk in. And so we actually, my deputy Danielle and I, we couldn't go to inauguration because we were among the first people to be sworn in the White House. And so when everybody was watching him be sworn in, we were walking down 17th Street in sneakers and sad suits.
Because you couldn't go?
Couldn't because the way that the town was shut down, the way that D.C. was cordoned off by police, it would have been impossible to cross over. So we said it was okay. We would watch on TV.
Was the gender imbalance particularly noticeable when you first arrived in the West Wing?
No. I would say that the gender imbalance was more perceived. You know, the press liked to write about it, like, because, you know, Barack Obama is a man. There were male senior advisors, but Valerie Jarrett was also there. And so the argument that some of the women actually had with members of the press was, we're actually there. Are you saying we don't count? Like, what's your story? And so we combated that as much as possible because it wasn't, we didn't feel it was that big of an issue.
And do you think President Trump is having the same problem? Yes, women there.
I believe that, I mean, his imbalance is much greater, but I don't know that he's as sensitive to it as President Obama was or would have been.
I'm speaking with Alyssa Mastromonaco, who served as assistant to the president and director of scheduling and advance at the White House from 2009 to 2011, as an assistant to the president and deputy chief of staff for operations at the White House from 2011 to 2014. Her book, Who Thought This Was a Good Idea? And Other Questions You Should Have Answers To When You Work in the White House, is published by 12, which means it's one of only 12 books published by that company in a year. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Alyssa Mastromonaco. Her book, Who Thought This Was a Good Idea? And Other Questions You Should Have Answers To When You Work in the White House, was written with the help of Lauren Euler, and it's published by 12. When you were promoted to Deputy Chief of Staff of Operations in 2011, did you have any doubts that about the job? Did you want it?
I did. I was very worried. It was such an immense responsibility. And most of the people who had had the job before me had, you know, some were older. I mean, that was basically all it came down to. And I was nervous. And I went to the president to tell him that I wasn't quite sure. And he came back, and Pete Rouse, who was a senior advisor, a counselor at the time, said, "Alyssa, you're the only person who thinks you can't do this."
You had to deal with a lot of dense briefing binders, you write.
Mm-hmm.
What was intimidating about the White House military office?
So the White House military office, one, is comprised of mostly military. And, I mean, there were in the – I have to remember this because I don't want to misspeak. But the White House Deputy Chief of Staff for Operations carries the same rank as a two-star officer. And so here I was. I would often do conference calls with people. And the one time I went down and the first time I chaired a meeting as deputy chief, they were all very courteous. And I sit at the head of the table with these generals and decorated military officers. And I guess my voice was much more serious than my appearances. And they said, we got through the meeting. They said, you know what, you should do meetings on the phone more often because you're much scarier. But we had quite a good relationship, but it was definitely out of my depth.
Did you spend most of your time traveling with the president and the first lady?
I did. I spent a lot of time as director of scheduling in advance. For the first 2 years, I did all foreign trips. And then as deputy chief, you take the role of acting chief of staff on trips. So I did more than half the foreign trips and many domestic.
You must have been astounded to be in this situation. You're talking to the top military leaders, as in some cases you're the one
yep.
on, or who's in command.
That's right.
And then you write about your first trip to the Vatican mm-hmm. with the president. Did you meet the Pope?
I did meet the Pope.
And then you accompanied Obama on his first trip to Iraq in March 2009.
I was the only only female member of the senior staff that was actually on that trip. And it was particularly memorable, not just because I had never been to Iraq before, but because I'd never been on a helicopter before. And we were expected to take quite a raucous helo ride to Baghdad.
Are you just going along, or is this a time when you're doing a lot of work?
Doing a lot of work. When you're doing something like the trip to Iraq, which was our first and also, I think, the only trip that we tacked on to an existing trip. So we had done our first visit to Turkey. And instead of going back to the U.S. and then going to Iraq, we decided to go to Iraq from Turkey, which is not standard practice. And so we were negotiating with the folks on the ground. And when you actually leave Turkey, you go into – or anywhere, you go into a radio blackout so no one can see the plane coming. And when we sort of went back into communications, when we turned the comms back on, we found out there was a terrible sandstorm in Baghdad and that we weren't going to be able to helo. And so in the 45 minutes from comms going back on to landing, we had to come up with an entirely different plan for what we would be doing.
And was the question asked again, who thought this was a good idea?
No, we didn't even have time to ask questions at that point.
So what did you do?
What we did was one of my great deputies, Emmett, was on the ground. He was working with General Ordierno, who was helping us on the trip. And what we actually did was we landed at Camp Victory, and we used General Ordierno's house, which I think was the home of Saddam Hussein's mother-in-law. And the leaders came to us, actually. They came via ground transport.
You include a brief interlude for some preparedness tips in mm-hmm. your book. What do you mean when you talk about that, being that kind of preparedness?
Preparedness? I think that I probably would have like a pretty serious anxiety disorder if I weren't prepared, and I combat it with, for example, the state dinners are wonderful experiences, but they are work, they are not parties. And the First Lady very much expected that we would understand and have, bits of conversation to have with whomever was seated to our right and our left from the hosting country. I always packed for every occasion. I mean, we could go from we could traverse three different climates in the course of one trip, and so it was always about taking a minute and looking ahead and making a list of what we needed so we didn't forget.
Is it possible to have a private life when you're doing all of this?
It's quite hard. I did not go on many dates in the White House.
Now, preparedness can't prepare you for certain things. A poll released just this month reveals that only 57% of registered voters believe that Barack Obama was born in the United States. That's this month.
Mm-hmm.
That despite the fact that Donald Trump disavowed the birther charge last September. Was the birther issue a major concern throughout the Obama presidency? Was it something that you had to keep on dealing with?
No. I think that once he was, you know, on the campaign, it was a problem. I remember the first... Goodness, I can't even remember, because I thought the birther thing was so insane. It's like, how can people even believe it? And I think that we did get to a point where this wasn't as big an issue, and then Donald Trump became president, and even though he disavowed it, it was in such a tepid way that I think it gave sort of fire to the idea again that somehow he wasn't actually a citizen.
You write that while your job wasn't policy-focused, you often sat in on policy meetings. Why were you invited?
It was very important for the most senior members of the team to understand what was going on in the world, how the president was thinking, what was going to be coming up. In terms of executing what he was going to be doing, planning for him, the first lady, the vice president, and the cabinet, we needed to have a very strong understanding of what initiatives were and why they were important.
You once sat in on a discussion about food stamps with a group of Ivy League-educated policy experts. And what prompted you to weigh in on the discussion?
So I like to call myself – there were meetings that if I was not actively participating in, I would call myself an auditor, basically. And they were talking about food stamps. And I had actually worked at the grocery store in Rhinebeck, New York, that, as I recall, was the only one for quite a few miles that took food stamps. And I saw what it was like for people who would come through with their groceries, like not this sort of, you know, this lore that people say. People are like scamming off of food stamps all the time. These were families that I knew that came through and were trying to buy what they needed, and they couldn't in some cases. And so listening to people sort of theoretically talk about the impact it would have on people when I knew the impact it had had, I felt like I had to stand up and say something.
And did it have much impact?
It did. The president, I was sitting behind the president, and he turned around and he listened to me. And I remember he said, good for you.
Alyssa Mastromonaco, her book, Who Thought This Was a Good Idea and Other Questions You Should Have Answers to While You Work in the White House, is published by 12. This is WMIC, WMIC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You said that the summer of 2012 was one of the most challenging periods in your professional life.
Mm-hmm.
Because... The re-election campaign?
Because, so as deputy chief for operations, you, on the one hand, have all of your existing responsibilities that I mentioned earlier. But then I was also the liaison with the campaign, because the one thing that Barack Obama cared very much about, and so did all of us, is that we followed all rules and protocols, that we weren't, you know, doing anything politically in the White House that we shouldn't have been doing. There was that. It also involved managing the campaign. And then towards the end of the summer, early fall, Benghazi happened. So there was a lot happening.
And then Hurricane Sandy. Are you surprised that everybody, the people in Congress, want to rush through the whole Russian investigation, but were perfectly happy to keep Benghazi going for years and years?
It's incredible.
Does that drag on the White House, or is it just a minor annoyance?
You know, I think it anything that diverts attention from things that could be happening that are productive, you know, is a drag. But I think they tried to sort of charge on.
What was your role in coordinating the federal response to Hurricane Sandy?
So the deputy chief for operations usually oversees internal response. And in this case, it was so massive. It was going to hit such an incredible population center. That I coordinated with John Brennan, who is now CIA director, but then was assistant to the president for counterintel and homeland security, and Secretary Napolitano. Between the three of us, we sort of like got into the storm. We saw it coming. I think it crossed over Puerto Rico October 25th. we prepared and did sort of pre-landfall declarations. But once the hurricane was, you know, approaching New York, I was able to, with the Department of Energy, Transportation, Agriculture, I sort of oversaw everything so that there was not one lever that wasn't being pulled, which is what the president said he wanted.
You were working primarily with the governor's offices in New Jersey and New York, but then you say at one point you went rogue. What happened?
So everybody, and this is a personal thing, everybody has their own way of how they want to do things, but it was, I had just started learning how to use Twitter. I was following the New York One Twitter feed, and I saw that, you know, the borough presidents and local officials, they were tweeting. And when we were doing a call, an update call with Governor Cuomo, his office said, you know what, it's fine. We'll just do the call with the governor and the senators. And I said, you know, I really think that we should include the borough presidents and some other, like, local folks. And they said, no, it would be fine. But I felt so much that this was going to be so intense that the president really, in order to really get done what we needed to get done, that he needed to hear from the county executives and the borough presidents, and the governor's office ended up being totally fine with it. They were lovely to deal with.
Why did you decide to leave the White House in 2014?
Couple reasons. One, it's a pretty exhausting job, and you're cruising off of adrenaline for, you know, in my case, it had been since 2007. And I felt that, you know, I had seen so much that, one, I was totally exhausted. And felt that my attitude was maybe not the best, and that whereas I'd always felt like I gave 120%, I was maybe hovering a little below 100, and that I knew that there was a really wonderful person to step up and take my place, and that, you know, she deserved the opportunity to have the experiences that I did.
Did you consider staying in politics and government?
No.
You wanted to go do something totally new?
I felt at that point that my identity was so wrapped up in Barack Obama and everything that we had done, that I wanted to try something totally radical and different and, you know, try and reinvent myself.
So you went to Vice Media?
I went to Vice Media.
Did you speak with any former Obama staffers after the November election?
This November?
No.
I did, yes.
Was there a sense that you were still involved with politics in your head?
You know, I think that so many of us, you know, when you go into the White House, there are always the people from the administrations before that sort of tell you what you're doing wrong or want to help. And we all wanted, we had our moment and we wanted to go and let the Clinton folks ascend and do their thing. And then after Election Day, I was on Jon Favreau and Dan Pfeiffer's podcast, and we talked about how it was like our job and our place to get engaged, even if it just meant marching.
What's it like observing President Trump's transition in the first 100 days in light of your own experiences working with the Obama administration? Do you sympathize with them at all, or especially with Trump's deputy chief of staff, Katie Walsh?
Katie Walsh is deputy chief, and also Joe Hagan, who I think was one of the best hires that they made from the Bush administration. And someone who I really thought could keep them on track. I want to be sympathetic, but I feel that that they look at everything that Barack Obama did, that we did, as literally just sport to kill, without understanding, as we did with the Bush administration, that there are a lot of good reasons that things happen, and maybe you should learn why that was before you just try to kill it.
What was your reaction to President Trump's claims that Barack Obama had the Trump Tower wiretapped?
Well, I will be honest. At first, I thought it was an article from The Onion. I could not believe that that a sitting president would say that about someone who had been so gracious to him in the transition. And, you know, shame on him.
A few days after the 2016 election, you published a letter to young women on the Vice Channel for Women called Broadly. Mm-hmm. What did you want young women to know in the wake of Hillary Clinton's loss?
You know, I thought it was pretty interesting, because I woke up the next morning after the election, and I was still crying because I couldn't believe that not only had Hillary lost, but she lost Donald Trump, which I'm sure was something she took much harder than I did. But I walked into the office, and it was like a morgue. And I knew that I had to do something that would sort of I tried to re-energize women and say, this is bad and we can be sad for a while, but we got to get back up at it, because politics is a pendulum.
And there was no one working at Vice who supported Donald Trump?
I don't know. I certainly did not ask. There could have been, but this was more about making women feel okay to mourn a little bit.
So now that you are part of the hated media,
yes.
Do you see yourself ever working on another political campaign in the future, perhaps for the Democrat who's going to oppose Trump for re-election in 2020?
I would say that I have always done quite well when I trusted my gut. And if I saw someone who I thought could really do it, who had the right message, who'd be great for the country, and if I thought that I had something to offer them, I would have a hard time saying no.
What about Barack Obama? Are you still in touch?
Yes.
Do you think he's going to remain active in politics, or do you think he just wants to move on?
I think that it will be very hard for him to see. I mean, I can't imagine. The last time I saw him was actually right before he left office. I can't imagine what it is for him to see what's happening now. I would imagine he will be one of the most sought-after surrogates and in the 2018 midterms. But, you know, I do think that in the same way that President Bush let us sit back and do our thing, I think that, you know, he will try to do that as much for Donald Trump as he can. Though I do know that Vice President Biden is up on the Hill today lobbying for Obamacare. So he's already back in the game.
And Hillary Clinton is reportedly has decided to come out of the woods, as they said.
Mm-hmm.
But you think that she it just hit her that hard that she felt like she had to pretty much go into seclusion for a time?
I think it was really smart of her. And I remember John Kerry did something very similar after 2004. You know, you don't want to do the wrong thing. And so sometimes you just have to take a beat and sit down. And I'm glad she did. She deserved it. She worked really hard.
So what are you doing now at Vice?
So I was at Vice for 2 years.
Oh,
and
you're not
actually
there?
I just transitioned. Vice and A&E Networks have a joint venture called Viceland, which is our television network.
Mm-hmm.
And so now I actually oversee Viceland on the A&E side.
And you preparing shows that deal with the topics we've been discussing?
It's all topical. A&E is not really news focused, but it is. We are relevant.
Alyssa Mastromonaco, her book, Who Thought This Was a Good Idea and Other Questions You Should Have Answers to When You Work in the White House, is published by 12 Books. And I thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you so much. It's an honor. I appreciate it.